We'll take your marker and place it to Isaiah chapter 40. Isaiah 40. For those visiting with us, we've been reading for several months now through the book of Isaiah prior to our studies. And as we come to good stopping points, we're, I guess you say, like preaching our way through those readings. Give us an idea of what the message is. It's a long book, and it's easy to lose sight of the immediate message. So we're going to do that today and remind ourselves of where we are. We're going to look at that chapter 40 by itself. Dalton finished up that reading today. With the last text that we did chapters 36 through 39, which was during the days of Hezekiah. And it didn't end very well. If you look back into chapter 39, this would have been our last study about a month and a half or so ago. It's the last time that we would have done these timely lessons of just reminding ourselves of this, of the readings. But you remember how it ended? In verse 5 of chapter 39, Isaiah said to Hezekiah, "Hear the word of the Lord of hosts. The days come that everything that is in your house and that which your fathers have laid up in store to this day will be carried to Babylon. Nothing will be left. Of your sons that shall issue from you, which you have begotten, they shall be taken away. They shall become eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon." Chapter 39 ends with captivity is coming. Slavery is coming. Bad things are going to happen to this nation. Bad things are going to happen to your kids. And that's where it ended. And imagine if that were really where it ended. If that was just the end of the prophecies of Isaiah. But it's not. I don't know how long the time period was between chapters 39 and 40. I've not been able to find anything that was valid enough to go with on that. But there seemed to be a time period. And if to use common vernacular that we would be aware of, we've all read books before, and you have what would be called book one. And then there'll be a couple pages of some blank pages, and then you come to book two. That's where we are. Beginning with what we call chapter 40 was the beginning of book two of Isaiah's prophecies. And it's really interesting how that division happens, because everything we've seen up until now has not been all that promising. We have seen that big section about the punishing of all the nations around them. And then we've just ended this section that Judah is not going to be immune to that. They're going to be punished. It's been one long, constant, downhill progression. And then from chapter 40 on, book 2, it was called the Book of Comfort. We're going to find out real quick why. Those who didn't call it the Book of Comfort called it the Book of Consolation. But everything is different about it. Larry Hedley gave me a little commentary thing that somebody had put together that was incredibly, it's just good thoughts in it. It's interesting. Now, we put the chapter breaks in. We understand that. But it's interesting that up at that book one of Isaiah is 39 chapters, which is how many books there are in the Old Testament. Starting here with chapter 40, there are 27 more chapters to go, which is how many books there are in what we call the New Testament. And this commentator went on to talk about the difference in that. That you had the Old Testament where there was sin, and there was a law that just couldn't prevail, and death. And then you have this new thought of hope and comfort and consolation. In a word, salvation. And that's how the message of Isaiah is about to change. It's about to do an about face. And we are going to have different thoughts. And the thoughts is, somebody's coming. There is a king to be crowned. And that captivity that he ended book one with, oh, by the way, you're going to come out of that. I'm going to bring my people out of it. And so there's where we are with this chapter 40 on its own, this tremendous chapter where Isaiah by prophecy is seeing and speaking of future things as if they were present. So let's just break down chapter 40 and look at the beauty that's there, because the theme changes, the tone changes. He's now speaking of this remnant that in the moment was not even born. But he's talking about this remnant that would return and a king to come. And so however long the interlude was between these prophecies, when he comes back, Here's the first thing he says. Comfort ye. Comfort my people. Speak comfortably to Jerusalem and cry to her. How you feeling? The first sentence is this, again, this message that there's a complete tonal change. And there is a change of emphasis. And there is comfort to come. There is consolation to come. He says, her warfare is accomplished. Her iniquity is pardoned. She has received of the Lord's double for all her sin. Me and you would say, time has been served. There was iniquity. I'm going to pardon it. There was consequences. Time has been served. It's been doubly served. There is hope. There is better future. In verse 3, after that, just that preliminary statement, comfort and hope and future joy. Well, that's just a statement. Unless there is something to back it up. You know, words are words. We learned that in our as we've been working our way through James. Words are words. Okay, those are some nice sounding words. But what are they based on? What gives them anything that would make us think there's some reality to that? Well, he's going to tell us that. Verse 3. Remember this phrase. We're going to hear this again. The voice of him that cries in the wilderness, prepare ye the way of the Lord. Make straight in the desert the highway of our God. If we were stopping a Bible class, who's that talking about? And everybody's hands goes up. Oh, that's John the Baptist. Secondarily, yes. By way of a New Testament application, absolutely. There is an application to John. But what did it mean then? Because they don't know a thing in the world about John. What did it mean to this group? He's talking about there's this desert. And there's a highway that's being paved. Verse 4. Every valley will be exalted. Every mountain and hill will be made low. The crooked will be made straight. The rough places will be made plain. The glory of the Lord will be revealed. And the flesh will see it together. For the mouth of the Lord has spoken it. These people who would have heard that didn't know a thing in the world about John the Baptist. What was the application to them? I'm bringing you home. You're going to be over here. But I'm going to pardon you. And time will have been served. And I will bring you home. And I'm going to clear the valleys. And I'm going to clear the hills. And I'm going to make straight the mountains. And I'm getting you from point A to point B. He's not talking about the Eisenhower Interstate System. He's talking about getting his people back where they are to be. And all of that is based on what? Verse 3, the voice of him. Verse 5, look at that last phrase in verse 5. The mouth of the Lord has spoken it. The incredible first sentence was, there is comfort to be had. There is consolation to be had. But that didn't mean anything if it's just words. But it's words coming from the voice of the Lord. It's coming from the mouth of the Lord. And look down into verse 8. The grass withers, the flowers fade, but the word of the Lord stands forever. Now we have some comfort. And now we can take that statement that Isaiah, imagine that we were part of that group hearing that for the first time, and now we know where it's coming from. There is comfort to be had, and it's because God has said it, His voice has voiced it, and unlike the grass that burns up and dies, unlike the flowers that look pretty for a day and then start to wilt and fade, His word, His voice, it stands, and it stands eternally. That's what this hope of comfort is based on. The captives are coming back. They will return. There's a pathway home. I have said it, and you can trust in it. That's how the book of consolation begins. In verse 9, we find something else about that we can take comfort in and realize that there is some validity to these statements. And it's, what we find out is it's not just His voice. Look in verse 9. O Zion that brings good things, get you up from the high mountain. O Jerusalem that brings good things, lift up your voice with strength. Lift it up. Don't be afraid. And unto the cities of Judah, behold your God. Behold, the Lord God will come with a strong hand, and His arm will rule for Him. His reward is with Him. His work before Him. It's not just His voice. It's this strong arm of God. Mark your spot. Here's the only time we're going to leave this chapter. But go back to Ezra chapter 7. Ezra chapter 7. Let's talk about that arm of God for just a moment. You remember Ezra? He came along after the events of Esther. He would have been a part of the return period. Remember, that's what makes this interesting. That's what makes this such a powerful point. Isaiah is prophesying about those who will return. Ezra is a part of that group that returns. You think he had read about Isaiah? Do you think Ezra, while in captivity, do you think that the prophecies of Isaiah was ever read? Would they have been aware of that? Of course they were. Now here's Ezra, a part of the group that came back. Look at chapter 7. I don't know if I ever put you in the right spot. Ezra chapter 7. Let's first of all just get an idea about who we're talking about. Ezra chapter 7 verse 10. Ezra had prepared his heart to seek the law of the Lord, to do it, to teach it. Ezra is a man that loves God. He has prepared himself to follow Him. When he finds out what it is, he does it. This is a man we need to give some heed to. Look back up into verse 6. It says, Ezra went up from Babylon. He was a skilled scribe. Well, I would say so. He's a skilled scribe. Now look at the last phrase of verse 6. The king granted him all his requests according to the hand of the Lord, his God upon him. Drop down to verse 9. On the first day of the first month, he began to go from Babylon. On the first day of the fifth month, he came to Jerusalem according to the good hand of his God upon him. Look into verse 29. Ezra speaking for himself about this. He has extended mercy to me before the king and his counselors and before all the king's mighty princes. And I was strengthened as the hand of the Lord my God was upon me. And let me just save us some time. I'm not going to take you into chapter 8. There's a homework assignment for you. Go find it. He says it twice more in chapter 8 once he gets to Jerusalem. Ezra understood how he got from one place to the other. Ezra stood. It wasn't about the power of himself. It wasn't about his strength. It wasn't about his might. He understood that it was the might of God, the strength of God's arm. And now you go back to Isaiah chapter 40, and that's exactly what Isaiah had said would happen. I'm going to make the path straight. I will bring you back home. It'll be by my voice. I have said it, and my word stands, and it'll be by my strength. My might, not your own. Here's a skilled scribe, Ezra was, and he understood this principle. Are me and you skilled enough to understand it and to give him the praise for his strength? In verse 12, we just sang the song. Couldn't have been a better song led to what we're about to this text we're about to go into. We just sang about a God that we are to be in awe of. We studied this morning, unlike during the days of Hosea, it's a God we need to acknowledge. And a part of what we need to acknowledge is the power of His Word and the power of His strength, which is what Isaiah is mentioning. In verse 12, he begins to throw questions out. Who has measured the water in the hollow of His hand? That's how he's talking. This God of wisdom, this God of strength, this God of power, he begins to throw out these descriptive phrases on it. Who has measured the waters in the hollow of His hand, meted out heaven with a span, comprehended the dust of the earth in a measure, weighed the mountains in scales and the hills in a balance. Verse 14, with whom did He take counsel? Who instructed Him? Who taught Him in the path of judgment? Who taught Him knowledge? Who showed Him the way of understanding? He's speaking of God. He makes the statement, there is comfort. There is consolation. Oh yeah, well give us some proof. He spoke it. He has the strength to make it happen. And then he begins to show all of this background. He says, who else is like Him? We stand in awe of a God who, if the question was posed to Him, how many gallons are in the Pacific Ocean? About that much. How wide are the solar system? About that long. How much does Mount Everest weigh? About this much. The hollow of his hand, the span of his hand, measures them in a balance. Verse 14, nobody told him this stuff. Nobody had to come and take him off to the side like we needed, and to be taught a clearer way, a better way, a more proper application. He didn't have to have that. Verse 15, as a comparison to that, behold, the nations are as a drop of a bucket. They're counted as small dust in the balance. We understand that concept of drop in the bucket. Imagine this 50-gallon tub full of water, and then somebody comes along with a little beaker and drops one extra drop in there. You will not even notice it. You wouldn't recognize it. It would not measure any differently. It's a drop in the bucket. Now, can you imagine these scales that are balanced, the old-timey scales, and they're perfectly balanced. But maybe we haven't dusted in a while, and maybe there's some lint floating around, and the lint comes and lands right on that scale. It's still perfectly balanced. It does not move. There is no distinction. And that is how the nations of the earth are described. A comparison between 12 and 14, the incredible power and strength that God has. And here's all these nations who rise and fall and vanish and disappear, and yet in the moment think so high of themselves. Put the United States in there. Put China in there. Put whoever you want to in there. Go back and we see history. Do you think that when Babylon was just smashing and ruling and controlling everything, do you think at the height of the Roman Empire, do you think at the height of the Athenian democracy, these people just sit around and say, you know, one of these days, yeah, this party's going to fall? No, they don't think like that. Nations don't think like that. Now, we had better, because we've got our eyes on unseen things and we know whose voice we're hearing to. But most people do not think about that. But all those nations I just mentioned are now in ruins. We spend vacations to go look at ruins. Do we have the foresight to realize one of these days, if this world stands long enough, people may be traveling to here? They may be traveling to this country and look at the ruins of what once was a powerful nation. Dust means exactly what it means. Nations drop in a bucket. Small dust on a balance. A little thing. Let's remember that the next time we vote. Let's remember that the next time we get so caught up in what CNN is saying, or what Fox News is saying, or whoever it is we like to hear the party line from. This nation will fall just like all the others. But there's a powerful voice who says there is comfort and consolation if we'll look for that. There is a powerful arm that can deliver us from whatever these earthly things may happen if we have trust in that. Drop down to verse 18. To whom then will you liken God? What likeness will you compare unto Him? With all these things that have been said thus far, it's like Isaiah just pauses and just says, let me throw a question out. Powerful voice, strong arm, all knowledge, all power, all wisdom, all might, unlike all the worldly things that we see. And now who are we going to compare Him to? Who do we liken to that? And who are we going to bring into our life to imitate that? And then basically He answers His own question with what they had done. Drop down to verse 19. How ridiculous this is. The workman melts a graven image. The goldsmith spreads it over with gold and casts silver chains. And he that is so impoverished that he has no oblation chooses a tree that will not rot. He seeks it unto a cunning workman to prepare a graven image that should not be moved. We've just been described about the awesome God we humble ourselves before. All knowledge, all wisdom, all of these things that we can't compare to. And he says, what are you going to liken Him to? And then he answers the question. I'll tell you what you do. We're gonna go get a silversmith, And we're going to have him form something for us. And we're going to put some jewels on it. And we're going to have it covered in gold. And then we're going to have this done. And we're going to have to prop it up to make sure it doesn't fall straight on its face. And we're going to carry our God wherever he needs to go. Oh, we'll take him with us. How ridiculous. Verse 21. Have you not known? Have you not heard? Has it not been told you from the beginning? Have you not understood from the foundations of the earth? Again, Isaiah pauses to just throw in, I guess, a 2018 version. Are you serious? Have you lost your mind? And the point he's emphasizing is, this is not new things. All of these things that we have read earlier, the things that Isaiah had said prior to this statement, none of this was new material. None of this should have caused one of the Jews in Judah to say, wow, I'm so glad you told me that. I can't believe that. I never knew that. Thanks for filling me in. Have you not known this? Have you not heard this? Haven't you been told this? Those are rhetorical questions. The answer to all of them is yes. It's he that sits on the circle of the earth. The idea is the horizon. He out there on the horizon. And the inhabitants are as grasshoppers. The point is, again, there's this comparison being made. He is there and we are here. He is there and we are grasshoppers. The strength of heaven laid out as a curtain, spread out as a tent. Can you put yourself, like maybe Ezra, can you put yourself in Babylon? Can you put yourself in captivity? Can you put yourself a long way from home in a heathen nation and yet this is read? Does the book of comfort mean anything? Does the book of consolation mean anything? Does this settle and does it amplify with us? Would it have? Look in verse 25. You remember what was said about the nations? Dust. Drops in the bucket. They rise up and they fall. And another takes its place. What about the leaders of those nations? Same thing. Verse 25. Speaking of God, it says, he brings the princes to nothing. He makes the judges of the earth as vanity. The nations come and go, so do leaders. Yea, they shall not be planted, barely planted. Dalton read for us this morning the translation he was using was scarcely. They are scarcely planted, scarcely sown, barely taking root. Those that farm in here and do gardens in the summer, can you picture? Oh, you don't have to picture it. It's probably happened. You plant and you sow and you do everything right. And the stalks come up. And then a big windstorm comes in. And every stalk of corn you've got out there is pointing every which way but straight. It was there. It was planted, but it wasn't rooted deeply yet. It was doing it, but not deeply, scarcely, barely. And then the wind comes and it's gone. Barely planted, barely sown, barely taking root. And he will blow on them and they will wither and the whirlwind will take them away. Picture some of the biggest world leaders you've ever heard of. Picture some of verse 23. Picture some of the most powerful princes and the most powerful judges. William the Conqueror. Blown. Alexander the Great, gone. And you just put anybody you want to there. Nations rising and falling. Rulers rising and falling. And all of that in comparison to a powerful arm of strength. Look at verse 25. To whom then will you liken me? Okay, so he had asked that question before. A little bit more information was given, and now the question is asked again. To whom then will you liken me? Who will you equal me to, says the Holy One? Lift up your eyes. Just take a look. Lift up your eyes on high, and behold who has created these things, and brings out the host by number. He calls them by name. There are places you can go this very day. And if you want to, I don't know how it got started. I don't know all the details of it. But there are places me and you can go today. If the money is right, you can name a star after a loved one. Did you know that? You can go out there and you can pay such and such organization, whoever they are, and you can have a name for your loved one. You know the problem with that? The stars already have a name. And the Creator is the one that gave it to them. Lift up your eyes. Behold who created these things. He brings out their host by the number. He calls them all by names by the greatness of His might, for that He is strong in power and not one who fails. He knows every one of the stars by name because He created them. They are His. Now what is all this getting to? You're a captive in Babylon. Imagine that. Imagine after all this comes to fruition. You are there, and yet here you are reading about a path that's going to bring you back. The desert's going to be made straight, and I'm going to go from here to here. It's going to be by the strength of God and the might of His Word. Verse 27, why do you say, O Jacob? Why do you say, O Israel? My way is hidden from the Lord, and my judgment is passed over from my God. The question that's being asked is, why would you think He doesn't know where you are? Why would you think He doesn't know your situation? Why would you think He doesn't know that you are hurting? He knows every star by name. And He loves you more. And now, present day application for us. Whatever our captivity thing may be. Whatever it is that, in the moment, kicking us in the mouth. In the moment, they have strength over us. In the moment, I don't think I can take another day. Whatever it is that's going on in here with us. Because there's a lot of people in here, which means there's a lot of things that can be in the way. Verse 27 is asking the question, do we really think God doesn't know? And do we really think God doesn't care? He knows and named every star. He loves us more because it wasn't the stars He sent His Son to die for. It was you He sent Him to die for. It was me He sent Him to die for. If He's aware and concerned about the stars, don't think that He's not aware and concerned about us. Comfort, consolation, that's what this book is about. Look in verse 28. Remember that strength? Strength of power. Strength of might. Strength that is not waver like nations and rulers. Well, he talks more about that in verse 28. Have you not known? Have you not heard? That the everlasting God, the Lord, the Creator of the ends of the earth, does not faint, does not grow weary. There is no searching of His understanding. Look in verse 30. Even the youth shall faint and be weary. The young men will utterly fall. The point he's making there is, and there's people in this room experiencing it, you're in the prime of strength. Prime of youth, strong as you will ever be. Nothing hurts for long. You get up and you can do it. And you get up the next day and you do it again. And there's people in this room that is a distant memory. You remember the strength of youth. But you have to think hard about it. You don't have it anymore. The point he's making is that is not how God's strength is measured. His strength is not measured by youth. And therefore, it doesn't age. It doesn't wear out. He's not 2,000 years weaker than he was during the days of Pentecost. No, his strength is not based on that. And so what can he do with it then? And here's the concluding thought of this. All of chapter 40, see this as a unit. The book of consolation starts. The book of comfort starts. That comfort is based not on words that of man. It's based on words of God that stand eternally. It's not based on the powers of rulers or nations because they come and go. It's based on the strong arm of God. And the strong arm of God is not about youth. And if that was all, well, that'd be enough to encourage us, right? If that was the end of it, that'd be enough to get some comfort and consolation out of, right? But that's not where it ends. Look at verse 29 and 31. He gives power to the faint. And to those that have no might, He increases strength. They that wait on the Lord will renew their strength. They will mount up with wings as eagles. They will run and not be weary. They will walk and not faint. It would be enough for us to take comfort just in the fact of knowing God's Word is powerful and God's arm is powerful. But what He's telling us is we take strength from that too. That very strength that we take comfort that He has can get us through the things we're dealing with. If you've looked at your bulletin, Joe Shane, that preaches on the other side of the county, wrote an incredible article, just two paragraphs, but it's just full of so many wonderful thoughts. And he's taking this verse, and he's talking about you go through the life on this earth where Satan's throwing darts at you, and you beat him today, and you feel good about that victory. And then tomorrow, there he is again. And sometimes we don't beat him. And sometimes it takes all of our strength to get through this. And then the next day, something worse is there, and you just don't feel like you can handle it. And yet here's this verse saying, your strength, my strength, it might sometimes be based on youth. And our strength in the flesh can sometimes waver, but there is strength we draw from that's not dependent on that. And so, what I mentioned earlier, there may be things going on with people in this very room. I just don't know if I can handle it. Yes, you can. The same thing that got you through this morning can get you through tomorrow morning if we're still here. The same thing that got you through your struggles last week will get us through our struggles of this upcoming week if we're fortunate to live through it. There is wings of light. There is arm of strength to all those who wait for Him, those who come to Him, those who are looking for Him, and how comforting this would be. If me and you were a captive in Babylon, how encouraging this would be. Well, we're not captives in Babylon, but we're in our own desert. We're in our own foreign land. Gene mentioned this past Wednesday night on his invitation. We are aliens. As we sing sometimes, this world's not our home. Well, we can sing it, but we might not think like it all the time. We've made this world our home all too much. If we don't see ourselves as pilgrims, if we don't see ourselves as strangers, there's a problem. We're in our own little present-day Babylon. And the same comfort that this was designed to give captives is the same comfort it was designed to give us. Chapter 39 ends with, captivity's coming. Chapter 40 begins with, but I'll bring you home. And I've got the strength to do it. And you've got to have the strength to endure it. Not through your own strength. Remember Ezra. Was it through his own strength that he understood the arm of God and the power of that? Look back into verse 11. We skipped this, but now we bring it back in. Remember that strong arm, that arm of power that's not dependent upon youth or world backgrounds? Verse 11, he shall feed his flock like a shepherd. He will gather the lambs with his arm, carry them to his bosom, and gently lead those that are with young. Get your songbooks out. Do you appreciate the message? The book of comfort begins, and how wonderful that is. Let's just not fail to see the comfort. Let's not fail to take consolation ourselves. What a wonderful thing it is that God, that strong arm that was described in so many various ways, with holding up this and measuring that, strong arm. And yet it was that same strong arm that takes us in and comforts us as children and as sheep. Jesus wanted to do it in Jerusalem. I will take you in like a chick gathers her hens. What a sorrowful thing for Him to be saying the same thing about us. I died for you, and you hadn't done a thing about it. I died for you, and you hadn't appreciated it. You've taken no consolation in it. Last time we'll be together in this year, fix it, whatever the it is. If you're not a Christian, He died for you. If you believe that by faith, then confess Him as your King. Repent of your sins. Be baptized to wash those sins away. And if we've done that, but maybe like Hosea's children, not showing the mercy we ought to show, well, then we can't expect to get it. Maybe we're headed straight toward Jezreel, the place of destruction. But we don't have to. And maybe we're not, because of our sin, His child. Because of stubbornness and arrogance, but we can be. That strong arm's ready to take us back. Take advantage while we stand and sing.